I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
This is the Computer Weekly
Downtown Upload
podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast. So we're recording on Friday, 24th of April. We've been in lockdown in the UK since 23rd of March. At least us humans have been in lockdown because our furry and feathery friends have not. We're seeing some rewilding going on. I had a bit of an incident this week. Shall I tell you about it?
Please do, because I'm very intrigued as to where this is going as an intro. But yes, please.
Well, I had my walk during the week, which is unusual for me because I tend to just do my walk at the weekend. But our boss instructed us to go for a walk at the beginning of the week, so I did. And then when I came back, I wasn't quite ready to get back to work. And we've got a kind of communal garden on our estate. So I thought I'll go in there for a few minutes. But the entry was barred by four very fearsome geese.
Okay. Is there like a lake or a pond anywhere near you? Or like,
it is. That does, yeah, that's onto the river.
Okay.
Where the garden is, yeah. But yeah, they were really quite fierce looking. I took a photograph of them. Obviously, I didn't proceed into the gardens because they were far too scary. But I did take a photograph of them. And they were socially distancing, which makes me think they are watching us.
Well, and they're emulating our behaviour.
Yeah, in preparation for some kind of takeover.
Oh, yeah. Geese are super territorial.
Mm. Geese are quite aggressive.
Yeah.
But that's the whole basis of a computer game last year. The Untitled Goose Game was just, yeah, like you are, it's a lovely day in the village and you're a horrible goose and you controlled the goose and you just went round being mean to people, stealing their possessions, swapping them round, making small children fall over and locking them in phone booths and stuff. There, you don't get a whole game based on you as a species if, you know, where you're basically a bit of a twat. If people think, oh, that's a nice kind animal.
If you're reasonable.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
They're like guard dogs as well, aren't they? They do have that function, I think. Mm.
Did they hiss at you?
I didn't allow them to get that fun. Cut short the interaction.
I don't blame you.
And
flame. They can be really, aggressive and hissy.
Mm. Yeah, so animals do seem to be getting a bolder.
I think it is quieter. So, a lot of, I live on like a main road, and this is quite a disgusting observation, but one thing I've noticed is there is a lot less roadkill on the roads. So there's probably more of them. So, you know, safety in numbers. Like, so there's a lot less squashed deer, a lot less squashed foxes and stuff like that. So there will be more of them. But also, if there's just not the noise as a deterrent to keep them away, because they are wild animals, they probably will come out a bit further than usual, I reckon.
Oh, then when everything returns to normal like 2025, for example, won't there be a lot more animals, you know, like accidentally getting run over because they're not used to the cars?
It is going to be a bloodbath, yes. Get David Attenborough on this. He'll know. But yeah, it is going to be a bloodbath. There is going to be wide-scale carnage. If, though, we do go back to
carnage.
Yeah, it's, yeah, we've noticed more hedgehogs and stuff around here. I think is just because there's not so much noise. Like, there's a pub near us that's a few doors along, and they've said they've started getting them in the pub garden, having never ever seen them before. So you just kind of think, in that environment, a pub garden is usually full of very loud drunk people making noise late into the night. So if you're a hedgehog, you're probably like, yeah, that's not my scene. But suddenly they're all gone. You're like, hey, yeah, let's live it up. So yeah, I get where they're coming from.
Yeah, that's really sweet. I like it. They're taking back their space.
Yes.
And what about domestic pets? How are they going to cope after? Because they're getting a lot of love.
Yeah, I think dogs are going to be upset, but cats are currently pissed off that everyone's at home bothering them.
In their space, in their territory, yeah.
Yeah. It depends on the dog. My sister's dog, usually, like, my sister's got 5 kids, so they're at home all day, and usually his time during the day is his like downtime. There's no noise in the house. He just sits there and like flops down and just lays there for like the whole time they're at school, not doing anything. now they're at home all the time, he's just like, my sister said, he's just exhausted, like he can't lay down anywhere, they just constantly want to play with him, and he's like, please leave me alone.
You do think of dogs as being those, you know, creatures that wait behind the door for you to come home because they're desperate for you to be back, but actually they might, you know, be like, oh thank god they're gone.
Well, like down, everyone,
it's nap time.
Yeah, like everyone, they got boundaries, you know. It's just like, yeah, this is fine, I do want to play, but come on, take my needs into account, please. But no, my guinea pigs are probably just going to get thinner when I go back to work, because they're just they're really, really noisy during the day. So to keep them quiet when I'm on calls and stuff, I do feed them like sort of little bits of extra food, just like, but obviously that's probably not helping. They just know if we're really loud and noisy and disruptive, we'll get more food, so we'll do that more. So they'll probably get a bit skinnier, I think.
But are they keeping nice and fit?
Yeah, like I say, they are. They're doing a lot of exercise, trying to battle each other, chase each other around all day. Trying out possibly for some kind of guinea pig triathlon or something. They do a lot of different activities. Keep it busy, like everyone, you know, got to make the best of the lockdown situation.
Top line in the rest of the podcast, listeners. So still on the animal theme, I'm going to be talking about otter. The transcription tool, much beloved of journalists, and how it's working with Zoom, Caroline. Mainly you're going to be talking about Green Flag and how it's going digital. Is that right?
Yeah. It's a nice little case study wrote up this week for the site, just about how they are using cloud-native technologies to try and bolster their position in the market from being the number three vehicle rescue service to hopefully get on the road, to be it becoming number one.
More on that later. Claire, you've got a couple of online food delivery stories.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about a couple of stories that I've seen on the web. Everyone's at home. There's probably a lot more people that are ordering food online, and these are just some sort of semi-happy stories that I saw on the web that relate to getting food delivered while we're all staying inside.
Cool. More on that later. And I've got an and finally story as well up my sleeve. But enough said on that for the moment. I'm just going to kick off with otter. So I had a conversation the other day with the CEO of Otter, a guy called Sam Liang, who was on played a leading role in the team at Google, who devised Google Maps. It's actually been out of Google for about 10 years now, but this is, so he's kind of playing that down a bit, but it's quite impressive, background. And it's quite a cool piece of technology. A lot of us use Otter to do transcribing. But this week they have released a kind of enhancement to their existing deal with Zoom. And it's a kind of real-time transcription product that works directly from Zoom, but also from Otter for Teams. But you know, a lot of us are using Zoom at the moment. We're using Zoom to do this podcast. And if we were using this sort of plugin thing, then we would see an automatic transcription of everything that's being said. And it is kind of cool to watch it in action. Our freelance colleague Adrian Bridgewater, he blogged about this as well, and his piece has got a very good summary of what it is, and we'll have a link to that. So in Adrian's piece, he begins his piece saying that nobody knows why Otter is called Otter, and he's very disparaging about otters. He says, typically spending most of the day scrambling for grubs, performing underwater somersaults, and occasionally posing for cute pictures, this member of the Lutra genus has poor office attendance record and is rarely seen in press conferences or in meetings, says Adrian. Well, I know why it's called Otter.
Why?
And why I know is I asked Sam.
Ah.
And this is what he said.
Ah.
He said, otters are very friendly. Well, at least they have a good image. Looks adorable. This is from the transcript that was automatically generated on the call. And he said, you see lots of pictures showing otters holding hands in water.
Okay. Yeah, so they hold hands so that the other one doesn't float away, right?
I think that's the reason why, yeah. Functionally, that would be the reason why. It's a very friendly thing to do, right? And he said, and in addition, most people don't know this, but the otter is one of the smartest animals in the world. He said it has a very high IQ compared to most other animals, and they have a very good memory. So that's why otter is called otter. And as I said, it is really cool to see it in action doing the automatic transcription. I'm not 100% sure of the value of that, though. I mean, how would we all feel about like an automatic transcription record, you know, and then living in the cloud and so on? So, and then there's a whole thing with otter anyway, which we've all experienced as reporters, which is it generates thousands of words.
Yeah, as someone who does use otter, they are thousands of words you can go through and edit. But if you know the bits, like with any interview, you know, as you're going through it, like, oh, that'll be the quote, that'll be the thing that'll hang the story off as you go through it. It just means, you know, help makes it easier to find those bits in the text rather than having to listen back.
Yeah, and you can search the text for keywords as well.
Yeah.
So if you remember that there was a specific topic that you spoke about that was interesting, you can search for keywords and it will just find you that part of the transcript.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's very searchable. And that's one of the points he kind of made about it. He did say some, I thought, quite interesting things about kind of, you know, conversation, especially conversation in meetings, which is that you can get distracted very easily. You might be on a Zoom call, your dog bursts into the office, drops a toy at your feet, and then you've missed a really important point. But if you had a transcription, you can immediately see the bit that you missed.
Yeah.
That's
true.
No, also just on that point, it kind of made me think there must be an accessibility sort of benefit to this as well. Like if you are kind of hard of hearing and you're in a meeting or something like that, you know, it's a lot easier to keep up with what's happening by watching the words. But I've seen that there's a lot of conferences now that I'll have on a board running concurrently with the keynote stage is like live captioning, sort of subtitles just playing out exactly what's being said as well. So it's quite important in that regard.
Another thing he said was people don't always listen. You know, you may be waiting to speak rather than listening. Mm. Especially in a meeting situation, it's like not a normal, relaxed conversation down the pub, but it's quite intense and stuff.
Yeah.
But if you've got the transcript, you can go back and see what someone said. Mm. And also you can annotate this as well and highlight stuff and things like that. So yeah, no, it seemed pretty smart technology, uses deep learning, and he, as with a lot of these kind of brain the size of a planet Silicon Valley types, he just seemed like a really nice bloke, and he's a big fan of the otter. I hope I've managed to defend the otter against Adrian Bridgewater's.
No, I was going to say there's a lot of good PR out there for otters. I think a lot of people like otters, so I think it'd take more than a blog post by Adrian Bridgewater to bring them down, to topple them. So
yeah,
it's all good.
On a completely different topic, there's a link. So, Caroline, you are back on the case study trail. After your life got taken over by something.
Yes, my life has been taken over by many things. I wrote a case study this week, which was, a bit of a palate cleanser, as it's like really sort of one of the first sort of customer stories I've written in a while. I've been so entrenched in the reporting on the fallout from the IR35 reforms and the loan charge policy as well, which we've talked about quite a lot on the podcast before, because both issues are sort of disproportionately impacting upon a big part of our readership at Computer Weekly, which is the IT contractor community. Yeah, I filed a piece last week or the week before, or just before the Easter break, that I've been working on for about 5 months around all the loan charge stuff. And it came in at over 5,000 words, and it was just like, ah, oh, it is done. You can read about it in the e-zine this week, and it's a story that's been quite a tangled web to pick through, and it's still unraveling. So that's 5,000 words on what the situation is at the moment, but there is going to be a lot more to tell on that. The gist of it is that there are thousands of IT contractors facing life-changing tax bills from HMRC because they previously opted to be paid in non-taxable loans instead of a conventional salary for the work they did. And these loans were paid out to them by offshore employee benefits trusts. And there's nothing illegal in what they've done, because that method of payment was within the boundaries of the tax laws as they were at the time. But in recent years, there's been a bit of a retroactive, as HMRC would say, rejig of those rules. And they've since declared that anyone who got paid in that way, you know, the tax they avoided paying by being paid in that way should be recouped, because those loans were loans in name only and they never intended to be repaid. So therefore, they should be treated as income and taxed accordingly. Except many of the contractors HMRC is pursuing for that in recent months have started getting letters out of the blue from organisations they've never heard of, telling them those loans are actually debts and those debts have been sold on and now they need to be repaid as well. So as well as the huge six-figure tax bills in some cases that contractors are facing, they're now being told they need to pay back much larger sums in some cases in loans on top of that as well. So they're facing a double whammy of payment demands, basically.
But do those loans also have interest?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's loans and interest that they're being pursued for on top of that. And it was always they were always told that because the way these loans were structured, you know, they're run by trusts and it would never really be in the you know, in the interests of the people who run those trusts to recall those loans in the same way, you know, it wouldn't be in the interests of the contractors for them to do that either. So there's always this kind of gentleman's agreement, if you will, that, you know, the loans would exist, you'll get paid that way, but they'll never be recalled. But now they have. They've changed hands and it seems like the people who've bought them aren't bound by the same rules or, like I say, this kind of gentleman's agreement almost, if you will. So yeah, so that's this feature. And so it's that the whole point of the article was to kind of dig into sort of, you know, why is this happening now? Who are these people who've come out the woodwork looking to reclaim those loans and that kind of thing? And just sort of dig in a bit to the impact that that's having on people. So as I say, it's a huge sort of spider's web of stuff I've had to kind of try and make sense of. And really, we first got wind of this story back in November when the letters first started appearing. And at the time, it was like a bit like, is this a scam? You know, is this just kind of, you know, are these people, are they somewhere on some kind of database? It's like, are these people affected by the loan charge? So these letters have just been sent out sort of as a, you know, a targeting activity at them or something like that. So it's taken a few months to get the full story on it. And it's, you know, it's not a scam. You know, these loans, the people who own them now are well within their rights to try and reclaim them. But it's whether or not they should be. It's like, you know, morally, is that the right thing to do? There's loads of unanswered questions on that.
Yeah, it does have phishing vibes, doesn't it? Except old school. So you get a letter rather than, and you know, like an email or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I mean, they follow a lot of the hallmarks you see in a phishing scam. Yeah, complete mess of a situation that has, like I say, it's basically taken me 5 months to try and make sense of. And yeah, there's still a lot more to come. We're only at the tip of the iceberg on that one. While I'm waiting for the next chapter of that to unfold, I've been cracking on with some case studies and cloud customer interviews, including one recently with the managing director of Vehicle Rescue Service Green Flag, who is a guy called Dean Keeling.
How many vehicles are really needing to be rescued right now? What I was going to say.
He said that even in these times, these mysterious times, he knows that there will be at least 1,000 rescues on the road each day carried out by Green Flag vehicles. He just doesn't know where they happen. If he could predict that, he'd probably be a very rich man. But he just knows that there will be that many. We are living in unprecedented times, and this story is certainly indicative of that because it is my first joint byline on Computer Weekly, as this write-up unintentionally turned into a tag team effort with our colleague Cliff. I'm not really sure how, and it would probably be rude for me to speculate on that, but both Cliff and I were booked in to interview two different people from Green Flag about its decision to ditch its 40-year-old Oracle database, on-premise database that it was running its business on. And we both found out on the day, so it's kind of a bit too late to reschedule or cancel the call. So we were like, okay, well, we hatched a plan and sort of tried to make the best of the situation. Because it turned out I was interviewing the MD and Cliff was interviewing one of the firm's techies. So I sort of said, oh, I'll cover off the business drivers for the project. Like, why are they doing this? And he'd dig into the sort of techie side of things. So they were looking to get rid of this on-premise 40-year-old Oracle database and adopt like a cloud native architecture, and that would include a move to the public cloud with AWS. And it seemed to work quite well, actually, this tag team effort that we did. But what the thing that, you know, was really interesting about the project, though, is that, you know, Green Flag is a 49-year-old company with an operating model that is actually sort of very modern, and it's one that sort of held up at a lot of the conferences we go to. Not Green Flag specifically, but the way they operate is one you hear a lot of CEOs at tech firms and conferences talk about, how, you know, in that Green Flag, they operate a car rescue service without owning any garages or aftermarket service providers, you know, in the same way that, like I say, tech conferences, you hear like, oh, Airbnb runs a holiday letting business without owning a single property. You know, it's that kind of thing. They've got a very modern operating model, but they're running on really, really old legacy technology. So the guy I was talking to sort of made the point that, you know, that's fine if they want to carry on the business as they have for the last 49 years and just do no more over and above than they're doing, that's fine. They could continue running the business. But its owner, which is Direct Line Group, have ambitions to become the number one rescue brand in the market. So they said, you know, investing in tech is something they're going to have to do. So that's going to help them. They said, you know, sort of become more agile, move into more business areas. And one of those is in like preemptive maintenance and upgrades of cars and stuff like that. So rather than just being there when someone urgently needs support with their car or anything, it's like, oh, maybe we could get into the business where we can use technology to let them know, oh, there's an MOT, your car will need an MOT soon, why not use one of our garages, or maybe pair them up with a garage that might help them do sort of cosmetic upgrades on cars and stuff like that. So they're not just there in an emergency, they're there for other less urgent things. So yeah, so it's, like I say, it's an interesting story. Cliff side of things digs into the techie side of what they were doing a little bit more. But no, it's just interesting, like I say, this disconnect between, like, oh, if you want to run a business in a modern way, you have to have a modern architecture. It's kind of turned on its head a little bit with this. Like, oh, it is possible. It just might not be easier to grow or scale, like, running that way. But it's, yeah, it was quite an interesting story to dip my toe back into the old customer stories.
So the legacy technology is Oracle. Oracle database, isn't that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 40 years, man and boy. That's the database that they've got, or they had. And trying to upgrade it, though, had become problematic in that there's, you know, if you upgrade one thing, something else will probably need upgrading. And it became very expensive. Also, from a skills perspective, with technology that age within a company, the people who would have the skills and experience to look after it maybe not so readily available and stuff like that. So digital transformation was an important part of this, but part of it was just, how do we just make sure we can keep maintaining our technology stack in the future? You know, it's got to be modernized, basically.
Yeah, because as much as you say they could carry on doing what they were doing and, you know, like, chug along and be fine on the technology that they're on and stuff like that, eventually that wouldn't have been the case.
Yeah, exactly. Like I say, you're quite happy being number three in the market, if you didn't have any other reasons for wanting to change or just keep on doing what you're doing. But that doesn't seem to have been, you know, a priority there. That, you know, they've got, their owner has big plans for that place and they're not going to stop till they get there. So yeah, there you go.
Do you think you may be doing more collaborations
with Cliff? Saren? Oh yeah. Hammer home the sort of car analogy. It was a complete cut and shut. I did the first half of the article, he did the second half, and you couldn't see the join. So yeah, he's a pleasure to work with.
And so, I mean, if Green Flag want to be in that kind of bracket as being spoken of as being like Uber or whatever, then they have to modernize their technology. We can't move on from that story, though, without saying that Caroline's piece on the loan charge is a brilliant piece of work. Involved a lot of investigation, and it leads the easy in this week. And I think you're doing the leader as well, aren't you?
Yeah, I had to write that this morning. Just like, oh my god, I've already written 5,000 words on this. What more do I write now? I was like banging my head against, like, yeah, I'm happy to do it, Brian. Yeah, happy to write that. Like, what the hell do I say now? But yeah, yes, it's I'm the leader.
Online food delivery disruptors. Maybe get a little segue into that. Claire, your fancy was taken by a couple of stories in that area, quite quirky stories this week.
Yeah. So I noticed on the Independent a story about Instagram and people being able to order food through the Instagram app. You would feel like it's a long time coming, really, considering that most of Instagram is pictures of food anyway. So Instagram have implemented an action button that can be put on like a restaurant's profile, and a food order button that can appear in stories. So like if a business has posted a story, that allows you to then purchase that through that food on the business's website. And the company said that it was to sort of help local businesses in this time, you know, because you just, every business is facing different challenges in this time, I guess, in the same way that every person is facing different challenges in this time. So it's a, you know, like an attempt to support some, you know, like local businesses or restaurants with this ability to, yeah, order food through the Instagram app, which I thought was a really good idea. There are times where you scroll through Instagram though and you see someone's posted some really good food and you're like, oh.
My worry would be the impulse control on that. Like, oh my God, I want it. You're like, oh no, like a finger slipped. Oh no, now I'm, yeah. Now food's getting
now good. Now I'm buying food.
Yeah. I think particularly in lockdown, the last thing I need is more ways to access food. It's like, no way. What I'm doing these days is eating. So yeah, so I'm not sure.
But you've got another story, haven't you, Claire, about a bit of online ordering?
Yeah, I do. I saw it on the BBC where a toddler was playing with her father's phone and then accidentally ordered a delivery for some onions from Morrison's. And even though the onions came to £1.50 because of additional charges, like a small order charge and stuff like that, the overall order ended up coming to £19.99 for some onions.
This story actually made me so angry because I've really struggled to get an online order like for weeks, and this baby comes along and just like a swipe manages to secure a Morrison's delivery. I'm like, oh my God, like I can't do that. I've never felt so old. Just it's like, you can do this. So yeah, it really made me angry.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you leave toddlers with your phones. I think she was 1 year old. But yeah, it's these digital natives, they can work it all out, can't they? Yeah.
It's me hammering my head against the wall, like, why can't I get a slot? Like, this kid's up. I've got some onions. Amazing skills.
Easy as pie. I thought that was really cute. It was, I got caught up watching the news on television. Because it was just on after something else I was watching. And I've been trying not to watch the news all day, every day, because it's rather, you know, depressing. But then this story was in amongst all of the bad stories, and it was quite nice to just have something that was a little bit different and a little less, you know,
we're all gonna die.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for that, Claire. But I've got another good news story to close us out as well. Another nature story. This is one by our Asia-Pacific editor, Aaron Tan. So it's not my story. It is about AI, which is kind of in my area. And it's all about keeping coral reefs healthy using AI. So it's a kind of environmental story about, there's a foundation called, I'm going to try and get the pronunciation right, Sulubai Environmental Foundation, which is a Filipino organization which is dedicated to protecting marine life. What they've done is they've somehow or other elaborated an artificial reef to go alongside the natural coral reef. And the techie bits provided by Accenture and Intel. So there's basically underwater video cameras here, and then Accenture's got a whole bunch of data analytics that it's doing through a neural network. Now, previously, to kind of examine the health of the coral and see how it's getting on and so on, you would use human divers to do that. Which is very expensive and very difficult. So this is using video cameras and then the artificial intelligence to monitor the health of this coral reef on the island of Pantagalan. I can't pretend I knew what that was before, which is in the Philippines. But it's a really nice story. All the kind of details in the story itself. So we'll have that link in the summary article. Mm. Yeah, I thought that was really nice use case of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
But hopefully it's having some benefit. It's having some kind of benefit. There is more detail in Aaron's piece. And Aaron also asked the project leader if it could identify new marine species or species that were thought to be extinct. Unfortunately, he said that the chances of that are quite small, but it is possible. You know, it is possible because at least, you know, the camera is detecting movement. And then the scientists can review the images more to see what the creatures might be. So, but that would be the extreme end of what the algorithm would be able to do, because it's been trained to recognise lots of fish and marine animals and stuff. So a really rare one would not really be in that data set.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really nice. Little fishes.
Mm. Yeah. Kind of brings us full circle, really, from the start to the end. It's almost like someone planned out what we would talk about today on this podcast.
Yeah.
No, that would never happen. More mundanely, getting back from Coral and all that. So my diary next week is starting to fill up with vendor briefings, sadly. What about you two? How's it looking?
I have... next week is going to be a week of IR35 stuff. I can feel it in my water, but mainly because at the time of recording I've just had an embargoed report on all that through, so I know that will happen. And I'm also working on a feature for Cliff, not with Cliff, for Cliff this time, on data center related things. So I've got a lot of interviews sort of lined up next week with people to talk to on that. It's quite an interesting one for a forthcoming buyer's guide on data center liquid cooling. Woo! Very cool.
Data center liquid cooling. So that's using liquids to cool data centers.
Yeah, instead of fresh air, which is what a lot of them use. So yeah, so there's basically...
I've never been to a data center in my entire 20 years of doing this stuff.
You need to get involved. Once the world opens up again, that should be on your bucket list. First must-go-to place should be a data center.
Well, this podcast has been a real eye-opener for me because we started with the most beautiful data center in the world, our very first podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, they're probably quite safe places to go in terms of social distancing. They're not really places you encourage people to sort of gather. They're, you know, entry into them is strictly controlled, temperature controlled as well. So, you know, if you're feeling a bit like you might not be very well, you'd soon know about it. I can't see any downsides to wanting to visit a data center really in the current climate.
Sold.
Mm. Are they quite socially distanced?
Yeah, exactly. And no one knows where they are either. So if you need to be on the run from the police because you've gone beyond your essential travel for the day, they wouldn't know where you've gone.
Claire, have you got any plans?
Try not to think about it. Let's just have the weekend.
Very wide. Let's get to the weekend. Yeah. Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. So just remains for me to say, as usual, thank you very much indeed to Caroline.
You're welcome.
And thank you very much to Claire.
Anytime.
And thank you to you very much for listening. Okay, stay safe and take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.